Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Tuesday, April 9th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Doug Kretzinger and Scott Splavik. And here's Scott with our first story.
Thank you, Doug. I'll start with the article entitled, Two More Utility Board Members Removed. Alleged they failed to provide oversight of the utility. It's written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Eldridge Mayor Frank King removed two more members of the Eldridge Electric and Water Utility Board this past week, alleging they refused to comply with council directives and failed to provide proper oversight of the utility and its employees. King sent letters dated April 5th to Barbara O'Brien and Paula Stewart, notifying them they were removed effective immediately from the board. It's the latest development in the city's rift with the municipal utility. Two other trustees were removed and two utility employees were placed on leave in the past couple months. The mayor's letters to O'Brien and Stewart cited willful misconduct, willful maladministration, and refusal to perform your duties as a utility board member, and accused the board members of failing to provide oversight of utility funds and employees. The letter cited 16 bullet points of allegations, including failing to address misconduct of the utility manager and utility clerk, failing to comply with the collective bargaining agreement, and failing to require financial oversight, approval, or authorization for utility employee expense reimbursements. Stewart, reached by phone, denied the accusations and said city officials were misleading the public. The letters state that a public hearing will be held before the city council on April 15th on their removal unless they waive their hearing, followed by a city council vote. The city council had scheduled a special meeting for 6 p.m. April the 8th to consider two new appointees to the utility board. However, the meeting was canceled according to the agenda on the city website. The agenda noting the cancellation did not give a reason. An attorney hired by the utility board sent a letter to the city disputing the legality of the council making the appointments. Under Iowa code cited in the mayor's letter, an appointed board member may be removed from office by the mayor with the unanimous approval of the city council. The board member must be given written notice stating the grounds for removal, and a board member is entitled to a hearing within 30 days. The council then must vote on whether to approve the removal of the board member. Under Eldridge City Code, board members may be removed for cause by the council upon written notice of charges to that member and after public hearings. O'Brien and Stewart are the latest board members to be ordered off the board in the ongoing dispute. On February the 14th, Utility Board Chair Brock Kroger was removed from the board because he no longer lived within city limits. Kroger is suing the city over that decision, arguing there is no residency requirement in state law. James Skadel was named interim chair, but the city council voted to remove him during an emergency meeting March the 27th. King called the meeting to recommend Skadel's removal because, according to King, Skadel refused to meet with him over an agenda released that King said would have violated state law. Speaking to the Quad City Times/Dispatch Argus on Monday, City Council member Scott Campbell said he supported the mayor's decision to remove O'Brien and Stewart. For lack of better word, it's a mess, and we've got to put an end to some of this stuff and move on, Campbell said, adding that he has nothing personal against the members of the utility board. Campbell said he believes some of the decisions by the board were not in the best interests of the residents, including the board hiring an investigator at its April 1st meeting that was quoted at $200 an hour for 20 to 40 hours of work. Campbell said in the past 2 weeks, city officials and city administrator Nevada Lemke have met with each utility board member and shared their concerns. But the utility board's hiring of an investigator, he said, in his view, was not in the best interest of the city. Campbell said he did not believe there had been any theft of public funds. Stewart said she met with the mayor, city administrator, and council member Ryan Iosi on March 28th, and everything felt very good. We were making progress, and we thought we would be able to come to a resolution. On April 1st, the utility board held a special meeting and agreed to hire an investigator to do a third-party review of city allegations against two employees that had been replaced, that had been placed on leave. King then sent the utility board members an emailed letter accusing the board members of interfering with the city's investigation of the two utility employees. If they want to come to a solution, why are they worried about us doing an investigation, Stewart said. Stewart said the city has not provided any accusations against the two employees on leave in writing. It's just been all one-sided hearsay, she said. They've just gotten rid of everybody, so they're taking over, Stewart said. This all started with an organizational chart. The mayor was there. The city administrator was there. We all agreed we needed a third party to explain how each organization needed to be run. Does the utility manager report to the board or to the city administrator? Everyone agreed. Then the next week, they got rid of Brock, and then it just spiraled. It was a train wreck. We have tried to work together, but every time we think we're taking a step forward, they start removing more people.
3 decades of identity theft. Who's the true Bill and who is the imposter? Is the headline on this article written by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline is Waverly. A ruse that lasted more than 3 decades could mean up to 3 decades in prison for one of the two men claiming to be Bill Woods. For years, the two men, identified in court records as California Bill and Wisconsin Bill, battled contending they were the one, true Bill, and calling the other an imposter. Both Williams acknowledge the other person's existence and claim the other person is responsible for their identity being stolen, wrote a University of Iowa police detective who investigated the dispute, which involved opening accounts at Waterloo and Dubuque credit unions and a Waverly insurance company. California Bill was homeless and destitute. In contrast, Wisconsin Bill was successful, working remotely and commanding $100,000 salary as a systems administrator for the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, a job that gave him the pinnacle of access to the hospital's computer system. So it was no surprise Wisconsin Bill often came out on top in a series of legal skirmishes, that sent California Bill to jail and mental hospital. Those skirmishes ultimately reversed on April 1 when Wisconsin Bill pleaded to charges of false statement to credit union and aggravated identity theft in the U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids. The charges solidified Wisconsin Bill's true identity as Matthew David Kearns, who had used Bill's name and personal information to take out loans and land jobs. Sentencing for Kearns, 58, of Heartland, Wisconsin, will be at a later date. He faces 2 to 32 years behind bars and more than $1.2 million in fines. Not much is known about Kearns before he became Bill. He would later tell investigators he dropped out of school and ran away at the age of 16 to travel across the country. Kearns had worked with Bill at a hot dog cart in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in 1988, records state. After 1988, there is no record Kearns used his real name, date of birth, or Social Security number, according to court documents. In Colorado, he obtained a fast food job under Bill's name in 1990 and opened a bank account using Bill's name and date of birth. The following year, he paid $600 for a used car, passing checks with Bill's name. The checks bounced. Kearns drove to Idaho, where the car broke down. He closed his bank account and left Idaho. Colorado authorities obtained an arrest warrant. In 1994, Kearns was in Salem, Oregon, where he met a woman who would become his wife. They had a son who took Bill's surname, and the couple moved about with Kearns pursuing computer jobs. She obtained a graduate degree. The son went to college. They paid their taxes and lived a normal life. The couple eventually settled in Wisconsin, where Kiernan's, still using Bill's name, worked at the corporate headquarters of a department store chain. When he landed the Iowa City position, passing a background check under Bill's name, he would work in Iowa and then make the four-hour drive back to Wisconsin on the weekends. The pandemic solidified his ability to work remotely from home the majority of the time. At some point, the real Bill, living in California, discovered Kiernan's was using his identity, living under his name, and using his information to take out credit cards, automobile, and personal loans. Loans investigators said totaled more than $200,000 over the years. The person who had spent $600 on a broken-down car was now buying $20,000 Jeep Cherokees. On August 20, 2019, California Bill, the real Bill, walked into the Los Angeles branch of a bank where Kiernan's had an account in Bill's name. Bearing his real Social Security card and state-issued ID, California Bill told the assistant manager someone was using his identity to take out loans. And while he was there, he asked to close out the bank account, removing all the money Wisconsin Bill had deposited. The amount involved wasn't immediately clear, but it was significant enough to prompt bank workers to ask a series of questions to verify if he was the one who opened the account. They were questions that California Bill couldn't answer. The bank manager called the phone number associated with the account and talked to Wisconsin Bill, who correctly answered the security question and said California Bill was an imposter. Kiernan's then faxed copies of his Wisconsin driver's license in Bill's name and a copy of Bill's birth certificate and Social Security card to Los Angeles police to establish his identity. California Bill was arrested and charged under Kiernan's name. Prosecutors sought a competency exam because he kept insisting he was the real Bill, and he was ordered to a mental hospital and prescribed psychotropic medication, court records state. California Bill ended up pleading no contest, not admitting guilt, but acknowledging he would likely be convicted at trial to identity theft as part of a plea deal. In all, he spent 428 days in jail and 147 days in a mental hospital. As part of the sentence, the judge ordered California Bill not to use Bill's name and only use Kiernan's name. California Bill apparently didn't follow the order and in August 2021 contacted Wisconsin authorities to complain that Kiernan's was using his identity and took up the matter with credit reporting agencies. Kiernan's stuck with his story that he was the real Bill and filed his own complaint with Wisconsin police. Meanwhile, California Bill went to University of Iowa hospitals and clinics where Kiernan's worked. The matter was passed to a University of Iowa police detective who talked with Kiernan's, who insisted California Bill was crazy and needed help and should be locked up. The detective then took an extra step in obtaining a DNA sample from Bill's father in Kentucky, who went by Billy, to settle the matter once and for all. The DNA results came back on June 20 of 2023, proving California Bill was the true Bill. An FBI fingerprint check the following month confirmed Wisconsin Bill was the real Matthew Kiernan's, according to court records. Confronted with the evidence, Kiernan's told the university detective, "My life is over and everything is gone," court records state. He went on to admit to using Bill's identity in every aspect of his life, including obtaining a copy of Bill's birth certificate in 2012, according to court records. In August of 2023, Bremer County authorities charged Kiernan's with submitting a false insurance application and forgery in state court for a policy he took out from CMFG Life of Waverly, using Bill's identity in 2019. Johnson County authorities filed similar charges for using Bill's birth certificate to get the hospital job and for using a license with Bill's name when he got a traffic ticket.
That is quite the story. An astronomical view. Next solar eclipse in the U.S. is August of 2044. This is written by Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times. Claudia Centeno and her dog, Anna Luna, met her cousins at the Moline Public Library to view Monday's solar eclipse. It was the first time viewing an eclipse in the United States, though the group recalled seeing one in Venezuela in 1970 prior to their move to Moline. The eclipse in Venezuela was really complete, Liliana Huguiri said. It looked like it was night outside during the day at that time. Centeno said she watched the 1970 eclipse at her house with her mother. It wasn't something like this with all the people out here looking through telescopes, she said, gesturing to the surrounding crowd. This event is great. For us, it's really wonderful. The Moline Public Library partnered with the Popular Astronomy Club of the Quad Cities to host a safe solar eclipse viewing event for families and community members. Attendees could visit QCPAC's mobile observatory and take a peek through several professional-grade solar-filtered telescopes. This event also aimed to help folks understand Monday's rare eclipse, featuring family-friendly games, activities, and educational materials. We've had a long history of public outreach, said Al Scheidler, former QCPAC president who now volunteers with the club. The mobile observatory debuted in the year 2000, he said, and makes regular stops at places like libraries and schools. It also visits the Niobe Zoo every third Saturday. Sisters Alexandria and Abigail Hauser said this was their first time witnessing a solar eclipse. I like looking at constellations and all that stuff. I'm super excited for the eclipse, Abigail, age 14, said. I feel like it'll be a super fun thing to see and experience since the next one won't happen for a very long time. After Monday, the next total solar eclipse visible in the continental U.S. won't happen until August of the year 2044. While the siblings find astronomy to be an interesting subject, both say they wouldn't pursue it as a career. At Scott Community College, coincidentally, Alexandria, age 18, took an astronomy class with Professor Robert Gregory. He does a lot with the mobile observatory. I enjoyed astronomy class. It was just a little too sciencey for me, she said. I'm quite excited for this solar eclipse. I think it's really cool how you can see the solar flares and corona around the sun. It's a cool experience you don't get to see very often. It wasn't Mitch Davis's first rodeo. The 72-year-old Moline native traveled to Missouri's zone of totality to view the solar eclipse in 2017. To avoid the hassles of traffic and potentially bad weather, Davis decided to watch this year's from Moline. Luckily, he came equipped with his own extended camera lens, a tool he usually uses birdwatching. We could have done it from our yard, but it's nice to be here with other people and experience it, Davis said. It's nice to see all the kids. They'll probably get to see it again. The QCPAC meets on the second Monday of each month at the Butterworth Center, 1105 8th Street, Moline, opening their doors to all astronomy lovers. The club is always looking for new members, Scheidler said, especially those interested in operating a telescope. If you want to join, there's your telescope right there, he said, pointing to the club's largest Schmidt case grain telescope out for use. I'm always looking for new telescope operators.
Moving to page 3 of the local section of the paper. Headline, second man charged in shooting. The shooting occurred in Davenport outside the M Lounge, written by Anthony Watt. And it says, a second East Moline man faces charges based on allegations he shot at the people outside a Davenport bar in March. Scott County authorities have charged Kane R. Smith, 21, with intimidation with a dangerous weapon, according to county court records or other documents. The charge stems from Smith's alleged participation in a shooting around 12:45 a.m. March 17 outside the M Lounge at 217 North Brady Street. After an altercation inside the bar, Smith and Quantrell Andrus Tapia, 20, East Moline, walked out with security, court records state. Smith and Tapia then got into a verbal argument with at least two people outside the bar. It was unclear if these people were involved in the earlier altercation inside. Authorities accused Tapia of then pulling out a .380 caliber pistol and chasing the people with whom he and Smith had just argued, records state, and the victims were trying to reach their vehicle. Tapia fired three times at the victims while their backs were turned to him, according to court records. The victims took cover and fired back at Tapia. Authorities allege Smith then used a 9mm pistol to fire at the victims six more times, records state. When he did so, the victims were trying to enter their vehicle. Security cameras recorded the fight, court records state. Police recovered three .380 caliber casings and 22 9mm casings at the scene. Bullets hit several vehicles. The courts issued a warrant for Smith's arrest on March 28, court records state. Davenport police arrested him Monday. Davenport officers brought Smith to the Scott County Jail late Monday morning, according to the jail website. His bond has been set at $10,000 cash only. His next court date was not available Monday afternoon. Tapia also faces charges from the incident, court records state. In his case, authorities filed counts of attempted murder and intimidation with a dangerous weapon. Police arrested Tapia on March 27, and he remained in custody Monday, held on $25,000 cash-only bond, according to the Scott County Jail. The court has set his next court date for April 16. So say the court records. And a couple more stories here on this page, local. I went to the wrong page. I mean on this next page, it's page 4 is where I was going to read. Man faces attempted murder charge. This is written by Thomas Geyer. A Davenport man has been charged in connection with a stabbing that occurred late Saturday. Serafin Gomez Mendez, 28, is charged with one count each of attempted murder and willful injury causing serious injury. According to the arrest affidavit filed by Davenport Police Officer Joshua Derner, officers responded to a home in the 1900 block of the West 4th Street at 11:28 p.m. Saturday to investigate a stabbing. During an altercation, Mendez armed himself with a knife and stabbed another man in the chest several times, causing life-threatening injuries. The victim was taken to Genesis Medical Center, East Campus, Davenport. His condition was not available Monday. According to the affidavit, neighbors heard a disturbance from inside the home at the time of the assault, surveillance footage indicated. Gomez and the victim were the only occupants home at the time of the assault. Attempted murder is a Class B felony under Iowa law that carries a prison sentence of 25 years, 70% of which, or 17 and a half years, must be served before parole can be granted. Willful injury causing serious injury is a Class C felony that carries a prison sentence of 10 years. Gomez was being held Monday in the Scott County Jail on bond of $35,000 cash or surety. He is expected to make a first appearance on the charges Tuesday in Scott County District Court when a judge will schedule a preliminary hearing in the case. And one final story here on this page. Local, two rescued in the Davenport house fire, written by Anthony Watt. Firefighters rescued a woman and a dog from a burning house in Davenport on Sunday. The Davenport Fire Department responded at 1:08 a.m. to investigate a report of fire in the 1200 block of Locust Street, according to a news release. When they arrived, firefighters saw light smoke, then found fire in the basement. Firefighters found the woman and dog on the second floor and got them out through a window in the back of the residence. The release states, the department received no reports of injuries. Crews had the fire under control within 10 minutes of when they arrived, and there was moderate fire damage in the basement and smoke damage throughout the home. Davenport Fire called the Red Cross to assist the residents of the home, the release stated. The cause remained under investigation Monday, the release said.
Back on page A3 with the local page, we've got Restaurant Week features energy drinks and margaritas. It's written by Laura Yeater of the Quad City Times. Here's a look at five of today's specials during QC Restaurant Week in the Quad Cities. From April 8th to April 14th, more than 100 local restaurants will be part of the 12th annual promotion hosted by local tourism and economic development organization Visit Quad Cities. First, we've got Pulse 83 Energy Station, which is located at 210 11th Street in Rapid City, Illinois. Today's special is a 24-ounce energy drink for $4.50. And on Thursday, you can get a spring latte slash bunny tail. They're open from Monday through Friday from 5 a.m. to 6 p.m., Saturday 7 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. And then for lunch, you can go to Flavors of India, located at 2660 East 53rd Street, number 8 in Davenport. Today's dine-in only special for lunch from 11 to 3 p.m. is free non-bread and rice with an order of entree, half price on all drinks from 3 to 5 p.m. during happy hour. Their hours are Tuesday through Thursday, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., Friday and Saturday, 11 a.m. to 11 p.m., and Sunday, 11 p.m. to 9 p.m., and on Monday, 4 to 10 p.m. For dinner, Los Portales, which is located at 1231 Fifth Avenue in Moline. Today's special is pick a dish from their special menu today through Friday from 1 to 8 p.m. for $5.99. Also, try a margarita tower Tuesday for $17.99. Their hours are Monday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Sunday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Today's bar is Foundry Food and Tap, located at 5055 Competition Drive in Bettendorf. Today's special is half-price appetizers nightly from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. For Restaurant Week, get 15% off your bill up to $10 by mentioning Restaurant Week. Hours are Monday through Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 a.m. And for dessert, we've got Cookies and Dreams, located at 6768 Competition Drive in Bettendorf, just down the street from the Foundry Food and Tap. The special is choose from 12 cookies in unique and classic flavors, $5 off a half dozen cookie boxes. No limit. Available for in-store pickup only. Must mention QC Restaurant Week. Their hours are Monday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Tuesday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m.
And here's an article, Gannon's Best Thing I Ate This Week, Fate Decided, written by Gannon Havenhold, along this line. It says, last week we put out a poll for readers asking where I should dine out for this week's Best Thing I Ate This Week column. Among the options were restaurants from across the Quad Cities, all of which are participating in this week's QC Restaurant Week. The results are in, and my dining fate has been decided. By a margin of exactly one vote, the winner of the poll was Palace Tavern, a bar and restaurant in East Moline. I wanted to try this spot for a long time. Based on their website's photos, the pizza looks delicious, and so do the sandwiches. I'm open to recommendations on what to pick. Palace Tavern is closed on Mondays, so stay tuned to see what I go with in the Best Thing I Ate This Week column about Palace Tavern coming later this week. So, folks, that puts us, I want you to know that you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and it's time we're going to turn now to the obituary section of today's paper. We have about three here and some pendings. First one is a Lorraine B. Fredrickson's, F-R-I-E-D-R-I-C-H-S-E-N, June 25 to April 7, 63, April 7 of this month she died. Lorraine B. Fredrickson, 60, fell asleep in death from a lifelong lung disease on April 7. She was surrounded by family and friends during her final weeks. Lorraine was born in Clinton, Iowa, June 25 of 63, Herbert and Hannah Lore Fredrickson. She is survived by her parents, her brother Jens, sister-in-law Melanie, and aunts uncles, and cousins. Lorraine symbolized her dedication to the Creator, Jehovah God, by baptism as one of Jehovah's Witnesses on June 16 of 1979. Lorraine attended Clinton Community Schools, graduated in 1981. In September of that year, Lorraine started in a voluntary full-time ministry. She participated in this Bible education work for over 25 years, despite her worsening health condition. Also, Lorraine enjoyed working part-time for Cadogan Chiropractic Clinic over 17 years. In her spare time, her favorite activities were photography and bike riding. Throughout Lorraine's life, she helped others, especially children. Her devotion to God, kindness, sense of humor, and loyalty to friends will always be remembered. Her family and friends look forward to the time when she will wake up in the early paradise that God has promised, Isaiah 25:8. Sincere thanks go to Dr. Hornick and his University of Iowa staff, Dr. Nassif of Ames, Iowa, and Dr. Dornbush of Clinton, Iowa. Also, we are very thankful for her friends that helped at Lorraine's bedside day and night during her final weeks. In addition, we thank the Mercy One Hospice staff and Lance from CarePro for their very kind care. Lorraine's memorial will be held on Saturday, April 27, 2 p.m. in Clinton, Iowa, Kingdom of Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses, 1100 11th Avenue North. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting snellzornying.com. Thomas Tom Babbage, B-A-B-I-J, 81, passed away peacefully at home on April 5. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, the 11th, 2024, at Wirtz Funeral Home. A funeral service will take place at 10 a.m. Friday, the 12th, at Wirtz Funeral Home. Tom will be laid to rest at Rock Island National Cemetery. Online condolences and fond memories may be shared at WertzFH.com, WERTSFH.com. Tom was born on January 8, 1943, Scranton, Pennsylvania, to parents Stephanie Kenya and Andrew Babbage, B-A-B-I-J. After graduating from high school, he attended Northwestern University. Tom continued his education within the United States Army, for which he proudly served until 1982. His time in the Army took him to many places, including Vietnam and Germany. It was in Germany and that he met the love of his life, Helena Iwank, I-W-A-N-C. They joined in wedded union, 1964. Their daughter, Veronica, came along once the family settled down to Louisiana. It was there in Louisiana that Tom enjoyed lots of fishing and hunting. Traveling continued to be an important part of his life, and the family enjoyed many road trips. Once retired from the U.S. Army, the family moved to Hawaii. Tom worked as data analyst until officially retiring in 2009. In his spare time, Tom loved to go dancing with his wife, Helena. He also loved to share his knowledge of the U.S. Army with his grandson, Nate. Survivors include his wife, Helena Babbage, a daughter, Veronica, spouse, Gabriel Anthony, grandsons, Nathan and Jacob, siblings, Christine, spouse, Fred Alexander, Bernadette, spouse, Hank Rollins, Andrew, spouse, Lori Babbage, Catherine, spouse, Gary Cholette, sibling-in-laws, Michelle Babbage, Christina, spouse, Herbert Carlo, and Ursula Garbian, Renate Milan, Irina White, Jennifer, spouse, Arnold Bentle, many nieces and nephews. He was in predestined death by his brother, Paul, and his parents. And here's one for Marion Butch Lee Corbin, 79, Pottersville, Missouri, formerly of Davenport, passed away Saturday the 6th. A visitation will be held Saturday the 13th of April from 9 to 11 a.m., followed by graveside service at Davenport Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials may be made in Marion's name to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Butch was born on July 18, 1944 in Nevada, Iowa, to Trulin and Mary Deeds Corbin. He was a 1992 graduate of West High School. 1993, he was united in marriage to Catherine Jones. They have enjoyed 61 years of marriage. Butch enjoyed NASCAR, Dale Earnhardt, the Iowa Hawkeyes, yard work, and most of all, his family. Those left to cherish his memory include his wife, Catherine, daughters, Lisa, spouse, Ross Rostenbach, and Andrea, spouse, Daniel Wilbanks, son, Stephen, spouse Connie Corbin, grandchildren, Mitchell, spouse Ivy Rostenbach, Brandon, spouse Jamie Rostenbach, Logan, spouse Stephanie Clark, Caleb, spouse Chelsea Pankey Clark, Cody, spouse Cora Epley, Dalton, spouse Jaden Epley, great-grandchildren Ethan Isaac, Alida, Isla, Violet, Coley, Hayden, Casey, and Lake Lynn, sister-in-law, Sandy Corbin, and many nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his parents, great-infant-grandchild Taylor, infant-great-grandchild Jackson, brother Herman Corbin, sisters Alta, Jesse, and Mary Caitlin.
Now here are the pendings. Margie Irene Reedling, Reedinger, age 76, and that's spelled Readinger. Age 76 of Bettendorf, passed away Sunday, April the 7th, 2024, at the Summit, Bettendorf. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial in Moline. Next, Phyllis M. Bassett, age 68 of Davenport, passed away Saturday, April the 6th, 2024, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Arrangements are pending at Esterdahl Mortuary and Crematory Limited in Moline. Gordon Kite, age 59 of Davenport, Iowa, passed away March the 3rd, 2024 in Davenport. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial in Moline. Brian J. Hoftender, age 58 of Muscatine, Iowa, formerly of Tulsa, Oklahoma, died Sunday, April the 7th, 2024. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan. Judith Irene Bovey, age 81 of Bluegrass, Iowa, passed away Saturday, April the 6th, 2024. Arrangements are pending at the Runge Mortuary. Daniel Huhnmuller, age 74 of Walcott, Iowa, died Friday, April the 5th, 2024 at Genesis East Medical Center in Davenport. Cremation will be directed by Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. George William Bill Ovens, age 58 of Rock Island, passed away Saturday, April the 6th, 2024. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Catherine Kate Carter of North Liberty, formerly of West Liberty, passed away Sunday, April the 7th, 2024 at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Arrangements are being handled by Henderson Barker Funeral Home of West Liberty. Sherry Luann Windland Fisher, age 59 of Matherville, Illinois, passed away April the 5th, 2024 at home following an illness. Arrangements are in the care of Wint Funeral Home of Moline. John Tholen, age 76 of Tipton, died Saturday, April the 6th, 2024 at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Arrangements are pending with Fry Funeral Home of Tipton. Wilbur Bud C. Hodges Jr., age 81 of Coal Valley, Illinois, passed away on Saturday, April the 6th, 2024 at Allure of the Quad Cities, Moline, Illinois. Arrangements, Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan. Charles Charlie Schneider, age 53 of Davenport, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, April the 6th, 2024 at Harmony Utica Ridge of Davenport. Arrangements are in the care of Wendt Funeral Home of Moline. Sally Jo Poston, age 78 of Davenport, Iowa, passed away Thursday, April the 4th, 2024 at her residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial of Moline. Dolores K. Russ, or Roos, R-U-S, age 82 of Fulton, Illinois, died Sunday, April the 7th, 2024 at her home. Arrangements are being handled by Bosma Ranke's Funeral Home of Fulton, Illinois. And Joseph E. Kastner of Davenport passed away April the 7th, 2024 at Unity Point Trinity in Bettendorf. Arrangements are pending at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home.
Time to move on to the opinion section of today's paper. And here is one entitled, Three Responses Show Us Just How Different Trump Is. It's written by Martin Schramm. And it says, this is a tale of three leaders. Leaders A and B are legislators whose names are known around the world. They recently made public statements that got them a world of attention. And meanwhile, leader C got all the attention he sought in his too familiar way. Leader A, who is Jewish and passionately pro-Israel, declared in a speech last month that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has become a major obstacle to peace. The problem, Leader A said, is that Netanyahu opposes a two-state Israeli-Palestinian solution that is Israel's best and only hope for long-term peace. He said Israel should hold a new election, suggesting it should occur after the war begins to wind down. Leader B, who is also Jewish and passionately pro-Israel, declared with greater precision last Wednesday that Israel should hold new elections in September to avoid a national rift. He said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hasn't moved more aggressively to bring back the hostages. Leader B was speaking as tens of thousands of patriotic Israelis have been clogging city streets protesting Netanyahu's mishandling of the crisis in Gaza. And that began with Netanyahu's failure to safeguard Israel from Hamas' horrific October 7 attacks and kidnappings. At this point, we need to identify the prominent names and different nationalities of these two leaders. Leader A is U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York. Leader B is Benny Gantz, leader of Israel's National Unity Party. Gantz, who has long been beating Netanyahu in polls, had joined the Prime Minister's wartime unity government, but now he has called on Netanyahu to hold new elections in September. Now you're all set to evaluate the crisis time performance of Leader C, who, as you figured out, is Donald Trump. In response to Schumer's impassioned effort to help Israel find an achievable path to peace, Trump chose to respond with perhaps the most personally and religiously prejudiced attack ever made by anyone who ever served as president of the United States. In an interview with one of his former aides, Sebastian Gorka, who now hosts a conservative talk radio show, Trump was asked what he thought of criticism of Netanyahu's policies that has been leveled by Schumer and other prominent Democrats, including President Joe Biden. "I actually think they hate Israel," Trump said. "Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves because Israel will be destroyed," Trump said. Well, Trump talked about pro-Palestinian demonstrations in America. "They are justifiably protesting the wartime death, violence, suffering, famine, and dislocation Israel has inflicted on Gaza." Quote, "Don't forget, when you see those Palestinian marches, even I am amazed at how many people are in those marches," Trump declared. "And guys like Schumer see that, and to him it's votes. I think it's votes more than anything else. He was always pro-Israel. He's very anti-Israel now," end quote. As Israelis retaliated against Hamas, the terrorists chose to hide in tunnels beneath the innocent civilians. Hamas was daring Israel to kill Palestinian civilians to get to them. Why? Hamas knew it would outrage the world against Israel, but Trump didn't focus on that. He chose instead to make false allegations challenging the religious faith and commitment to Israel of all Jews who don't support him. Interestingly, last month, Gantz was among those who criticized Schumer's decision to publicly criticize Netanyahu and call for new elections. Gantz said Schumer was interfering with Israeli politics. But last week, Schumer was quick to support Gantz's decision to call for new elections and to do so with a specific time target of September, Schumer said in a statement. Schumer said in a statement, quote, "When a leading member of Israel's war cabinet calls for early elections, and over 70% of the Israeli population agrees according to a major poll, you know it's the right thing to do," end quote. Of course, there's another way to make the same point. When a leading member of Israel's war cabinet calls for early elections and over 70% of the Israeli population agrees, According to a major poll, you know it is the wrong thing to do to claim that a devout American Jew who takes the same position they do hates Israel and hates their religion. It is way past time for America's patriotic and self-respecting Republicans to unite at least enough to demand that their leader conduct himself according to the values that once made their grand old party great.
Our second opinion piece is entitled Unexpected Source Offers Advice for Fixing Congress. It's written by Bradford Fitch, who is the president and CEO of the Congressional Management Foundation and a former congressional staffer. He wrote this for The Fulcrum. After watching President Joe Biden's State of the Union address recently, it would be easy to conclude that members of Congress have little interest in and do not value civility, bipartisanship, and collaboration as a means to address the challenges our nation faces. But a recent survey of some other folks who were also in the House chamber the same night shows those principles are still respected on Capitol Hill. These people are the men and women who work as staff in Congress. The Congressional Management Foundation conducted a survey of senior congressional staff late last year, and the results offer a roadmap to improving Congress as an institution. It also showed some positive signs that when members of Congress work in a civil and bipartisan fashion, they can actually improve our democratic institutions. The survey and study, The State of the Congress in 2024, is by no means a ringing endorsement of the legislative branch. When staffers were asked if they agree with the statement Congress currently functions as a democratic legislature should, only 19% agreed. Yet civility and bipartisanship were clearly identified as necessary for Congress to succeed. Republicans, 85%, and Democrats, 70%, said civility was very important to a functioning legislature. And 60% of Republicans and 51% of Democrats said encouraging bipartisanship was very important. Virtually all Republicans and Democrats agreed that it is necessary for senators and representatives to collaborate across party lines to best meet the needs of the nation. Democrats, 68%, and Republicans, 73%, report personally experiencing direct insulting or threatening messages or communication, at least somewhat frequently. It's alarming that there are people who feel it's okay to spew vitriol at congressional staff and fire off death threats to elected officials. Importantly, the rising volume of rhetoric could affect whether congressional staff stay in their jobs. When asked how frequently they questioned whether I should stay in Congress due to heated rhetoric from my party, 59% of Republican staff said they are at least somewhat frequently considering leaving Congress compared to 16% of Democrats. A House Republican Deputy Chief of Staff said it in this way, "Typically, when asked about civility, I think about it in the bipartisan context, but civility between members of the same party has declined dramatically." Yet the research did yield some good news. Since the year 2019, the House of Representatives has engaged in a bipartisan and constructive effort to improve the capacity of the institution to function. The Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress and the new Subcommittee on Modernization are model efforts in problem solving in legislatures. We compared the recent survey results with identical questions posed to similar congressional staff in 2022, and in every area, staff satisfaction improved. While there is always more that can be done, over the years I've worked at the House, I think there's been an impressive evolution of support in support services offered to employees, said a House Democratic Chief of Staff. The leaders of these efforts are to be commended as outstanding public servants seeking solutions to institutional problems. The chairs and vice chairs of these congressional panels, Representatives Derek Kilmer, a Democrat from Washington, William Timmons, a Republican from South Carolina, and Stephanie Bice, a Republican from Oklahoma, have demonstrated remarkable creativity, persistence, and collaboration to enact tangible reforms to how Congress operates. While recent research shows Congress has a long way to go to reach the vision of our founders to build a more perfect union, congressional staff have offered both confirmation that progress can be made in this area and guidance on what still needs to be done.
Time to go to sports. We have a little bit of time left here. Front page of the sports section on April 9, Tuesday. UConn cruises past Purdue for second straight title. This time we're talking men's basketball. Glendale, Arizona is where it was written. Eddie Pels, AP national writer. UConn delivered the latest of its suffocating basketball beatdowns Monday night, smothering Purdue for a 75-60 victory to become the first team since 2007 to capture back-to-back national championships. Tristan Newton scored 20 points for the Huskies, who won their 12th straight March Madness game, not a single one of them decided by fewer than 13 points. UConn was efficient on offense, but won with this with defense. Huskies, 37-3, limited the country's second-best three-point shooting team to a mere 7 shots behind the arc. Purdue only made 1, while happily allowing 7'4" AP Player of the Year Zach Edey to go for 37 points on 25 shot attempts. UConn won its 6th overall title and joined the 2006-2007 Florida Gators and the 91-92 Duke Blue Devils as just the 3rd team to repeat since John Wooden's UCLA dynasty of the 60s and 70s. Purdue made it as this far a year after becoming just a 2nd number 1 seed in the history of March Madness to fall in the first round. But the Boilermakers, 34-5, left the same way they came, still looking for the program's first NCAA title. In what was supposed to be a free-for-all in this new age of the transfer portal and name, image and likeness deals, UConn has figured out how to dominate. The 2024 Huskies are the 6th team to win all 6 tournament games by double-digit margins. They won those games by grand total of 140 points, blowing past the previous high 121 by the 2009 North Carolina team for the highest margin among the exclusive club. Cam Spencer, a transfer from Rutgers, Stephen Castle, a blue-chip freshman, and Alec Caravan, a sophomore from last year's team, spent the night guarding the three-point line and making life miserable for Purdue's guards. This was the only the second time this season Purdue didn't put up 10 three-point attempts. And how about this final score? Edey, 37. The rest of the Boilermakers, 23. How serious was Coach Dan Hurley about defending the perimeter? When Braden Smith wiggled loose for a semi-open look to make Purdue's first three of the game with 2:17 left in the first half, the coach bolted onto the floor and called timeout. And that was that from behind the arc. Edey battled gamely, finishing with 10 rebounds to record his 30th double-double for the season, but this game proved the number crunchers right. UConn let Edey back in and back down all night on 7-2 Donovan Klingon, giving up difficult twos in exchange for any threes. Meanwhile, as Edey started wearing down, the Huskies took the ball right at him. Castle finished with 15 points. Bo Spencer and Klingon had 11. And it barely mattered that UConn made only 6 three-pointers, which was right at its season average. Hurley joins former Florida coach Billy Donovan in the back-to-back club and is in company with Bill Self and Rick Pitino as only the 3rd active coach with 2 championships. Nobody will say the UConn coach didn't work for this one. In the first half, he begged with, swore at generally berating the refs about over the backs, elbows, and hip checks that weren't called. Once, when that didn't work, after Edey set a hard and probably legal pick against Castle, Hurley started in on Edey himself as the center walked toward the Purdue bench for a timeout, but the coach's best work came in whatever hotel room he used to draw up the game plan. Well, we're about out of time, so want to know what's on TV? Do you know that, Scott, what's on TV? Here we go.
Yep. Yep, we can run down the TV listing here quick. We got college baseball, Florida at Florida State on ESPN2 at 6 o'clock. College softball, Clemson at South Carolina on ESPNU at 6 o'clock. Major League Baseball, the Chicago White Sox are at the Cleveland Guardians at 5 on NBC Sports Channel Chicago. 6:45, you got Philadelphia versus St. Louis on Bally Sports Midwest. And at 9 p.m., Chicago Cubs versus San Diego Padres on TBS. In the NBA, 6:30 p.m., Boston at Milwaukee on TNT. 7 p.m., New York at Chicago on the NBC Sports Channel. And 9 p.m., Golden State at the L.A. Lakers. And in hockey, 6 p.m., Washington at Detroit on ESPN. And 8:30 p.m., we've got Minnesota at Colorado on ESPN.
About time to wrap it up. A couple headlines. We're not going to read them, but one of this is written by Dave Selvig. It says, GOAT debate is dumb, but Clark is the greatest. Another headline on here, front page, Bettendorf nets a victory. And one more, Storm tweak roster heading into playoffs, the SPHL playoffs, Quad City Storm. So, folks, that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, April 9th. I'm Doug Kretzinger. My partner at the microphone has been Scott Splavik. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device anytime at iowaradioreading.org. We thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service, and we hope you have a great day.